Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sports Talk Chicago's 30th podcast. My name is John Zagluel, owner and operator of this site. We have a lot to get to today, covering all of Chicago's sports teams, and later in the show, we have a special guest coming on to talk some Chicago White Sox news. But first, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram, all at John Zags. Also, if you're looking for a place here in the Tinley Park area to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art classes for both adults and children, check out the Arts and Crafts Studio by Moochie World, where inspiration meets creation. You can find them at the Tinley Park Down Shopping Center at 7913 West 171st Street in Tinley Park. Give them a call at 708-247-2100. Again, that's 708-247-2100. Well, we're going to start off today talking about the Chicago Bears. Now, the NFL Combine happened just a week ago, and there were numerous players who garnered some attention. Guys we didn't know about, people who were projected to go fourth round, now moving all the way up to rounds two or one. Now, this year, the Bears, they're in an important position. They've got the number 8 pick in the first round and subsequent picks thereafter in the 2nd through 7th. So I want to take this time to look at some top players that the Bears could be drafting with that 8th overall selection. Via mock drafts and via my own predictions, I feel that there are 3 players whom the Bears are going to draft. 3 key guys who they are keeping their attention on. Now the first one is Quentin Nelson. Went to Notre Dame. He's an offensive lineman, 6'5", 330 pounds. This guy is just a mammoth of an athlete. So with Notre Dame in 2015 and 2017, he was named a consensus All-American. By the way, that honor was also given to Baker Mayfield and Saquon Barkley, 2 guys who are also projected to go in the first round of this year's draft. So it's not some random award that means nothing. There's a lot of meaning behind it. And historically, players who have gotten this award have done good things at the college level, obviously, but then going into the NFL as well. So a big deal there for Quentin Nelson. Second of all, according to Dane Brugler, who is an NFL draft scout, he says, quote, "I'm not saying I would take him number one, but he's a better guard than any player is at their position in the draft. He's a dominant player you project as a plug-and-play. He's nasty. He's going to come in day one, and you're going to start him and not worry about position for a long time." By the way, as far as historical information goes, the last time a college guard was taken in the top 10 of the draft was in 2013, and before that, it was in 1983. So Quentin Nelson is making a big deal for a reason. This guy's got heart, he's got hustle, and he's got the stats and the honors to prove that he is worthy of being drafted in the first round. The Bears could use some offensive line help. They just got rid of Josh Sitton, former Pro Bowler. Kyle Long has had injuries in the past that have derailed him from being on the field. Nelson would be a big help to Mitchell Trubisky as he enters his second year as an NFL quarterback. Now, another player who has been named in many mock drafts as a possible fit for the Bears at number 8 is Denzel Ward. Ward is coming from Ohio State. He's a cornerback and defensive back, 5'10", 191 pounds. Now, his freshman year, he didn't play a lot, only in 5 games at 5 tackles, but 2016 and 2017 were years for him to remember. Now, 2016, he played in 10 games, 12 tackles, and last season, all 14 games for Ohio State, had 2 interceptions, 37 total tackles. He was also named a consensus All-American in 2017, so he's sharing that honor again with Quentin Nelson, Baker Mayfield, and Saquon Barkley. Now, the funny thing about Ward is that before the Combine even began, he was already projected to go top 10 in many NFL mock drafts. Some had him going to the Bears at the 8th overall pick, others to the Jets at number 7. Either way, he was always fluctuating from that 7 to 10 spot. So at the Combine, he really raised his stock because he tied for the fastest 40-yard dash time at this year's Combine at 4.32 seconds. This guy is a speedster. He also had 15 pass breakups last year, further proving that this guy is able to run downfield and keep up with anyone that he is defending. The one problem I see for Ward and him coming to the Bears is the fact that they just tagged Kyle Fuller. So the Bears made a commitment now financially bringing Fuller back after his great season. So will the Bears decide to invest yet again in another cornerback in the NFL draft? Of course, before when Ward was projected to go to the Bears, that was during the time in which we didn't know if the Bears were going to retain Kyle Fuller. It was kind of in a limbo situation. Now that we know that Fuller is coming back, the question remains, will the Bears decide to double dip on cornerbacks and draft Denzel Ward? And then finally, the last player who I could see the Bears drafting with that 8th overall pick is Calvin Ridley, wide receiver, 6'1", 190 pounds, from Alabama. Now, he's been the consensus pick, at least in regards to other mock drafts. He's been the most popular guy people have been associating with coming to the Bears. Now, that's for good reason, because the Bears do not have a good wide receiver. We've talked about this many times in the past. Even last year when we were looking at training camp for the Bears, they never had anyone who was panned out for them last season at the wide receiver position. They need someone. And think about this for a moment. The Bears were tied to Jarvis Landry this entire offseason. Well, guess what? He's off the table now as the Browns just acquired him via a trade, as well as Tyrod Taylor. So now that Landry's off the table, who are the Bears going to get at wide receiver? I mean, sure, there are some options as far as free agency goes, Paul Richardson and Allen Robinson, some of the bigger names, but still, those guys aren't necessarily number one type caliber receivers. So taking a look at Ridley's stats throughout his years at Alabama. Rookie season, 1,045 receiving yards, 89 catches. 2016, 72 catches for 769 yards. And then last year, one of the best years, I think, in his career. Now, although he had 967 receiving yards, he averaged 15 yards per catch, which is a big deal. And get this, now he's only played 3 years at Alabama. He's foregoing his senior year. And he ranks 5th all-time in the SEC in receptions with 224. This guy is the real deal. The only way in which I could see the Bears passing on Ridley is simply because of history. In 2015, which was Ryan Pace's first year at the helm, the Bears decided to draft Kevin White with their first-round selection. We all know today how that ended up working out. So will Pace, because of history, decide to pass on Ridley because of the receiver that he drafted before was a bust? That's the question that I think the Bears have to overcome if they want to draft Ridley. If they don't, they're going to look to free agency to sign a wide receiver. And with that, we're going to move on now, talk about the Chicago Bulls, who are still in season. And there was a big headline that came out a couple of days ago from the NBA to the Bulls. Now, to provide some context, I'm sure you may remember on the last podcast we had, I mentioned how there are going to be some reduced minutes for some starters like Robin Lopez and Justin Holiday. And I said, okay, great. Now they're going to start tanking. Finally, they're realizing this will help them get a top pick in the draft. Well, the NBA has fought back. They told the Chicago Bulls earlier this week to stop resting starters, but held back on imposing a fine. They told the Bulls, basically, stop tanking. We can see what's going on, and we don't like it anymore. Last month, the Bulls announced reduced minutes to regulars like Holiday, Lopez, and Jerian Grant. They were going to increase playing time for guys like David Nwaba, Cameron Payne, and Cristiano Felicio. The NBA doesn't like that. They disapproved of the lineup changes because after the Bulls made those changes, they went 1-5 in the next 6 games. At the same time, they also warned the team to stop resting healthy players like Lopez and Justin Holiday. Okay, give me a break, because now they're being contradictory, the NBA is. Tell me if this is okay. When the Warriors have a game in which they don't want to win or they don't care for, when they're facing a crappy team like Sacramento or even the Bulls, certain guys are quote-unquote healthy scratches. Like when the Bulls and the Warriors played, Klay Thompson was a healthy scratch, but nobody seemed to mind. But now that the Bulls are doing bad and trying to get a good draft pick, there's a problem? Give me a break. I hate that idea. Stop being contradictory with the way you're going to approach players in games. If you don't like it when somebody's being rested on a healthy basis, then ban it for the entire league. Don't go after teams who are trying to rebuild their franchises and become relevant soon. It's just hard for me to believe that the NBA is going to go after the Bulls because they're sitting guys, the team's 22 and 42, yet when there are nationally televised games, which bring in lots of money, lots of revenue for the NBA, they're not going to go after those teams, like the Warriors and Cavaliers, who always designate their players as healthy scratches. When there's a big game and everyone's watching, and you've got Stephen Curry as a healthy scratch, or Klay Thompson or LeBron James, the league is losing money. That's a big deal. But yet you're going to go after a team in Chicago, a team who has barely any nationally televised games because they're so bad, and you're going to tell them to stop resting their starters because you can tell that there's a suspicion for tanking? Come on now. Get it right. As for the Bulls at the moment, they're in the 12th spot out of the 15 teams in the East. So that just further proves that even if they're trying to quote-unquote tank, they're not even doing it right. They're not even in last place yet. Why don't you go after a team like the Hawks or the Magic, who are way behind the Bulls, who are losing nearly 50 games already, even though the season isn't over. Stop picking on the Bulls for doing something that everyone else is doing. Go find someone else to go parade about this, but stop coming over here to the Bulls and doing it, because it makes no sense and nobody's going to win from it. The Bulls aren't a primetime NBA team anymore. Why does it matter if they're trying to tank or if they're trying to rest some starters? Go after one of your bigger revenue makers, your bigger giants, like the Warriors or Cavaliers, and talk to them before you come here to the Bulls. Well, we're going to move on now and go to the north side, talk about some Chicago Cubs news. Now, spring training's in session, the Cubs in Arizona right now, getting ready for the season opener at the end of the month. But right now, a big question coming out of camp is, who will be the opening day starter? Right now, let's talk about their options and evaluate who would be their best choice. Now, first you've got John Lester, a proven winner, multiple World Series champion back in 07, 13, and with the Cubs in 16. Last season, though, not his best year. 13-8 record, which was fine, but a 4.33 ERA, and he failed to hit 200 innings for the first time as a Cub. So Lester coming off of a subpar season, not a horrible year, but not his best by far. Is he qualified enough to start for the Cubs come opening day? Now I feel that Lester, for once, will not be this year's opening day starter due to the amount of talent that the Cubs have near the back end of their rotation. Because coming up next, we have Yu Darvish, whom the Cubs just signed to a big deal. 6 years, $126 million. Darvish is a perennial superstar. As we mentioned in our last podcast, when Darvish came here to the MLB, coming from Japan, it was a big deal. In fact, he was probably one of the most touted prospects to ever come out of Japan and then do well in the major leagues. Darvish last season, another year in which maybe he wanted to forget, though. Kind of similar to Lester's case. Darvish had usually pitched well in previous seasons, but last year went 10-12, the first year in which he has ever finished with an under 500 record as a starting pitcher here in the MLB, and also had a 3.86 ERA, which was his highest since his rookie year when it was 3.90. So Darvish had some troubles last year. There are two things, though, that I feel are going well for Darvish. One, the Cubs just signed him to this mega contract. Like when the Cubs signed Lester, that first year, he was the opening day starter without a doubt. Number two, Darvish has a knack for striking guys out, as I love to point out. This guy averages 11 strikeouts per 9 innings, and when on the mound, he is dominant. So hopefully, if he could maintain his successes from previous years and prove to Joe Maddon through spring training that he's worthy of starting, he will be that opening day starter because of his electricity and because of his name. And although Jose Quintana and Tyler Chatwood are good pitchers in their own right, I can't see either of those two contending for the opening day start. So my final pitcher who I'd like to look at is Kyle Hendricks. Now, personally, if I got to choose, I would pick Hendricks every time because he is one of my favorites on the Cubs. He is so good at locating his pitches, not necessarily a fireballer, but still getting outs and pitching to a good ERA and a good record, in fact. I mean, you can't forget 2016. He went 16-8, led the league in ERA at 2.13, led the league in ERA plus at 196, finished third in the Cy Young Award voting. Now, last year, he was hampered by some injuries, but when on the mound, he was still effective. 7-5 record, 3.03 ERA, 123 strikeouts, and 139 and two-thirds innings. Despite all those numbers, there's one thing that comes to mind when I think of Hendricks and why he should be an opening day starter. What makes Hendricks the ideal choice to be the Cubs' opening day starter is the fact that he was grown by the Cubs through their farm system. Darvish and Lester were two big signings via free agency, but Hendricks was homegrown in the Cubs' farm system, came up and blossomed. I think that because of that, because of his numbers, because of his background, he should get that elusive opening day start for the Cubs. We'll now move on to the South Side, talk some White Sox baseball, and some devastating news for the White Sox coming out of spring training. Number 3 White Sox prospect Luis Robert is out 10 weeks. He sprained his left thumb and it will be immobilized for 6 weeks. According to MLB.com, Robert suffered the injury while sliding into second base on a stolen base. He remained in the game and actually hit a game-winning grand slam in the 8th inning. But after the game, you know, once the adrenaline of that situation is out of you, you realize just how painful that injury could be, and Robert was really hurting. He ended up getting seen by team physicians, and in the end, he was diagnosed with a moderate grade 2 left thumb ligament sprain. So due to the injury, Robert right now will be limited to cardio training for 6 weeks until the cast comes off. Once the cast comes off, he'll have 4 weeks to recover, plus some extended spring training time before being assigned to an affiliate. And what a shame that is, too, because this season, in spring training, hitting .300 with one homer, four RBIs, and a stolen base. His confidence was growing. He was just starting to, I feel, turn a corner, and now he's going to be sidelined for an extended period of time. One more headline coming out of Sox camp is the closer's role. The Sox right now do not know who will be their closer come opening day. The top two options so far are Joaquin Soria and Nate Jones. So let's talk about both those guys for a moment. Now, Soria has a lot of closing experience. Actually, with the Royals, he had a couple of 40-save seasons way back early on in his career. And overall, he has 204 career saves. Believe it or not, he even made two All-Star teams in 2008 and 2010. So the guy has a lot of experience. But the last time Soria regularly saved games was in 2015 with the Detroit Tigers. That was after the implosion of Jose Valverde and Francisco Rodriguez. Jones, meanwhile, only has 3 saves to his name in his entire career. Mostly the Sox have been using him as a setup guy because over the past couple of years, they've had David Robertson as their closer. Jones got 3 saves in 2016, and last year obviously had the injury, only appeared in 11 games, so he was unable to get some reps as the closer. So the question is, who would be the better option for the Sox come opening day? Although Soria has the experience, I'd actually go with Nate Jones in this situation. 2 reasons why. Number 1, he's familiar with the team and the franchise. He's a homegrown product, starting his career in 2012 with the team. This year will be his 7th year with the same team. He's familiar with the catchers, familiar with Don Cooper, the pitching coach. All of that certainly plays a role into it. And number 2, I think he deserves a chance. He's been a setup guy all this time, has pitched to a career ERA of 3.12, and averages over 9 strikeouts per 9 innings. I think that Jones deserves to get a shot before you pass on him and hand it off to a seasoned veteran. We now go to the ice and talk about some Chicago Blackhawks news before we get to our special guest. The Hawks right now, a 30-32-8 record, 68 points total, and in last place in the Central Division in the Western Conference. A dismal year, to say the least. Now, we talked about on our last podcast how they needed to run the table and win. It was 30 of their next 32 games to make the playoffs. Now, unfortunately, that is not going to happen. The Hawks will not be making the playoffs for the first time in a very long time. But Joel Quenneville doesn't seem to be that worried about it. The other day, Quenneville went to a college hockey game between Northeastern and the University of Massachusetts and watched top prospect Dylan Secura score 2 goals. Right now, he's 3rd in the country with 48 points, 17 goals, and 31 assists in 31 games. Sakura, by the way, is expected to sign with the Hawks later this month whenever Northeastern season ends. As a senior, the 2014 sixth rounder can become a free agent if he chooses not to sign, but the Hawks are confident he will sign with the team. So, although this season was one in which the Hawks wish to forget, the good thing is, because of the fact that they've been doing so well over these past 7 and 8 years, they're recruiting big-time players out of college. This guy's third in the country with 48 points, and it looks like the Hawks are going to get him. According to Hawks GM Stan Bowman, quote, "I'm not trying to bother Dylan so much. I have spoken to his family advisor, I guess. He doesn't have an agent since he's a college kid. But we've had some discussions about how that would look and when he would be here. That's definitely our plan." The future for the Hawks looks even brighter when looking at some younger players who have contributed so far this season. Take this for instance. Matthew Highmore scored his first career NHL goal, added 2 blocked shots and 2 hits in 15 minutes and 48 seconds of ice time, even though the Hawks lost to the Bruins. Eric Gustafson had a career-high 3 points in that game. Alex DeBrincat and Nick Schmaltz each registered an assist to maintain their position amongst the top 4 scorers on the Blackhawks. There's a lot to be looking forward to come next season. And even though this year for the Hawks didn't go as planned, they have enough pieces to allow them to stay relevant in the years to come. And with that, it's time for our special guest. He was the first overall pick of the 1977 MLB Amateur Draft. After spending 3 years in the minors, he was called up for the 1980 season, which was the start of an illustrious 22-year career. During that time, he made 6 All-Star teams, finished with 384 home runs, and had over 1,600 RBIs. After serving as a first base coach, bench coach, and assistant hitting coach, he is now a Chicago White Sox team ambassador. Please welcome the legend himself, Harold Baines, to the show. Harold, how are you doing today? And thank you for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
I'm doing great, and it's my pleasure.
So, first off, I'd like to take a look back at the 2017 White Sox season. Now, we all know it wasn't ideal, underwhelming record to say the least, but there were some bright spots. Avi Garcia truly broke out into his own as a hitter. Jose Abreu had another career year. So, even though last year did not end the way you guys wanted it to, what did you see that excited you about the future of this team?
The youth of them, they're playing the game right. They came up short a lot of games, but they were almost in every game they played. They never gave up. They played the whole 9 innings, and that's what Rick DeRio has brung to this team. Got these kids believing in their abilities, and they're taking it out on the field and trying to win some ball games.
So, speaking of the future now, the Sox have many prospects that will soon contribute at the major league level. I know you're at spring training right now. You've gotten to see up close and personal guys like Yoan Moncada, Luis Robert, who recently got hurt, and Eloy Jimenez. So, what have you been seeing from these guys during spring training, and is the hype around them for good reason?
Well, I just been here a couple of days, so everybody, from what I hear, is the hype is there and the talent is there. I didn't really get to see Robert. I hurt his hand. Like, I think he's been hurt for the last week. And they just sent him minutes down, so I didn't get a chance to see him play. But everything, the future is bright. You know, the kids are working hard, and they've been here for 5 weeks, and they're ready to go.
So all these prospects, they're very close to making their MLB debuts, and many are speculating about when the Sox will make it back to the postseason. So far, the popular prediction is that the team will make it back in 2020. What do you think about that deadline? Do you think that's something that is achievable, or do you see it taking a little more time for everybody to mesh and develop?
Everything's achievable. You got to go out there and play the game. So I don't like to make predictions. Baseball is a long 6 months period of time to play the game of baseball. So you just go out there and play and see what happens.
So I wanted to shift gears now and discuss your amazing playing career. You were the first overall selection in the 1977 MLB draft, and at the time, you were 18 years old. You made national headlines. So what was that like for you, being 18 years old, being selected first overall, and, you know, being the face of an organization at that young age? And early on in your MLB career, did you feel any pressure by being that top pick? Did you feel like, you know, the team was on your shoulders because there was so much hype around you? What are your thoughts on that?
No, not at all. I came in at the right time. I had a lot of veterans around me that kind of took care of me. Carlton Fisk, he had Greg Luzinski. When I first got here, it was Chet Lemon and Lamar Johnson. They really took care of me, taught me how to play the game right, and I try to give that back to the kids today.
So I wanted to go to the 1983 Sox team. I mean, what a legendary team that was in franchise history. They won 99 games, and you were a key part of that team. You hit 20 homers, drove in 99 that year. What made that year so special for you and for the team?
Bro, you keep going back to these old dates. I'm not going to remember a lot of them. Going back over 30 years. I mean, I was still a baby then. I had a bunch of veterans like Luzinski and Fisk. And all those guys, now I got one of the players messing with me while I'm talking to you on the phone. But, you know, I was still young. I mean, that was my third year in the league, so I was still trying to learn how to play the game correctly, and they were teaching me how to play the game. I had Tony La Russa, too, which I had in Double A, and he became a manager in 1980. So he brought a lot like what Rick DeVria is doing these days with these players.
So, and the next year, and I'm sorry for bringing this up, another little historical thing, but I'm sure you would remember this. I mean, you were part of the longest game in Major League history, lasting over 8 hours, spanning 25 innings, and you ended up hitting a walk-off home run, finally ending that game. It must have been so relieving. Tell me about that experience. I mean, being a part of a game that felt like it would never end, I can only imagine how that would have felt.
Well, I think that'd be the last game I ever played where you go home and sleep for 8 hours and come back and finish the game, which, you know, we played 17, then we came back and played 9. Unfortunately, I was able to hit a home run in the 25th inning, took a 20-minute break, and came back and played 9 more innings.
My goodness, that just, that turnaround, you know, and you think about players today, you know, they're barely able to play 9, even pitchers today the same, and you were able to play like a span of like 36 innings in like 48 hours. That must have been insane.
It was insane, but I mean, it's a job. You got to do it.
Definitely. So after your playing days were over, you were a bench coach for the Sox when you guys won the World Series in 2005. How special was that for you? I mean, you broke an 88-year World Championship drought, and you were a part of many good teams, as I mentioned, that 1983 team, and you finally got a ring with the 05 Sox. How was that for you?
I mean, I think it's, you know, I wasn't fortunate enough to get one as a player, but I think everybody that's in the game of baseball, their one goal is try to get a World Series ring, and I was fortunate enough to be in Chicago at the right time, and the players wanted me a ring for me.
Do you remember the final out? I mean, what was that like? Everybody storming the field, and, you know, you being in the dugout and all that, you know, the atmosphere. How was that?
Well, if you look at me, I would end up very excited because I'm not a whole lot of stuff in, but all the coaches hug each other. It's really about the players at the time. They put in all the hard work, so we just let them sit out there and enjoy it, and we just try to, you know, congratulate each other for doing a great job and bringing them over the hump.
So following your career in 2007, you were eligible to be elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame, and I'm sure you hear this a lot because I really think that you should have gotten more of a chance to, you know, get looked at. You fell off the ballot in your first year, and you have the numbers. I mean, 2,866 hits, 384 home runs, over 1,600 RBIs. I guess
yeah.
The voters didn't agree. So what were your thoughts on this? Do you feel like, you know, you should be a Hall of Famer? Because I think you do.
No, I can't. I mean, you can't I'll leave it up to other people to think that. You know, I'm not that selfish of a person. I just play the game to two reasons, to take care of my family and try to win a World Series ring. Not all the other stuff, if it comes along, that's great, but I'm not really thinking about stuff like that.
I agree, you know, definitely. That's the right mindset to have, definitely. And on a final note, I wanted to get your thoughts on what happened in 2008 when the White Sox unveiled a bronze statue of you in now Guaranteed Rate Field's outdoor concourse. I mean, you were immortalized by the Sox with this honor. What did that mean to you?
I think it just goes back to the organization appreciating the way you played the game, the way you treated the fans. And it was a very special day for my family and I. I come from a very small town that stuff like this doesn't happen. I was very honored that they bestowed that on me, and I cherish it every day.
And speaking of the fans, one more question. I know while you were playing, it was very popular. You would come up to bat, and the fans would be chanting your name, be going, Harold, Harold, you know. I just wanted to ask you, how was that for you? You know, all these fans centering around you at your at bat, you know, that must have been very kind of distracting, of course, but also you must have felt pretty proud, huh, to be the face of that franchise and for everybody to be rallying around you like that.
It usually happens when, you know, late in the ball game and you're trying to win a game, and unfortunately for me, I was able to come through a lot of times for that to happen. I still hear them saying now and then when I see older people at the ballpark.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, Harold, thank you so much for being on the show. It was a pleasure and awesome to have you on.
Thank you very much.
What an honor it was to have Harold Baines on the show. I was telling him off the air, you know, I wasn't able to necessarily see him play a lot, but I've seen highlights of him. His numbers are amazing, and it was just really awesome to have him on the show, talk some Sox baseball, and also talk about his great career, which is underlooked by many, but still very meritable and very good. Well, we're going to move on now to our final segment, my personal favorite, the announcer's call of the day. And we had Harold Baines on today, so it's very fitting to have a highlight from him. So here's the situation. It's 1983. The White Sox are one win away from clinching the AL West division. Harold Baines is up at the plate with a runner at third, and all they need is to score that run to win it all. Let's listen in and see what Baines ends up doing.
Stand at the plate in that. And Del Crandall is going to bring the infield in. The outfield is shallow. Vandenberg will work from the stretch. And that is into shallow center. It's just for the run. Cruz tags. Here's the catch. Here comes the throw. Here comes Cruz. And that's great, the Golden Ray. The Chicago White Sox. The 1983 Western Champions in the American League. And you think there aren't some happy people on the field.
All right.
Harold Baines with the game-winning RBI. The White Sox win it 4-3.
And there you have it. Harold Baines winning the AL West Championship for the White Sox there back in 1983. And you know what's even more interesting is that season, he led the American League with 18 game-winning RBIs. Talk about a clutch player. Well, thank you so much for listening to today's podcast. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at Chi Talk Sports. Hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram at John Zags. And also, subscribe to the website, so that way when we post new content, you can get it directly in your email. Go to the spot where it says enter your email address, enter it in, and from then you will be on our mailing list. Thank you so much for listening to today. Thank you again to Harold Baines and the Chicago White Sox for scheduling this interview and for having him come on the show. Thank you again, and have an awesome St. Patrick's Day weekend.